Hello, podcast person, and you're a very special person if you're downloading this. Thanks for choosing this podcast. I'm John Hockenberry, host of The Takeaway, a program that's produced by WNYC and Public Radio International.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. John Hockenberry is out this week. Thank you so much for listening on this Tuesday. Today, how to get treasure from what we think of as trash. We'll introduce you to a musician from Illinois who turns old hard drives and phones and keypads into instruments and teaches kids about programming and music. And we're sidling up to the card table this hour with a look at how the deck is stacked for those incumbents seeking re-election to the Senate this year. It's part one of a card game we're calling Senate Hold'em, and Ken Rudin is here to play with us. But we start again with the deepening crisis and carnage in the Middle East. The pause in hostilities over the weekend replaced by one of the heaviest nights of bombardment in Gaza. A fuel tank supplying the area's only power station has been hit, with reports that power to the 1.8 million people in the Gaza Strip has now been cut.
I'm now south of Gaza City. This is the main fuel storage facility for Gaza's only power plant. It too was hit by an airstrike overnight, and there's not much you have to say about it. You can just look at it. Huge fire and flames and a massive plume of smoke stretching up into the sky. And there are still Israeli planes overhead and sounds of explosions.
That's BBC reporter Chris Morris on the ground in Gaza. Earlier, one senior PLO official called for a 24-hour humanitarian ceasefire, something that has since been rejected by Hamas. This once again underlines the divisions in the Palestinian leadership, with different factions pulling in opposite directions. What's not in dispute is one direction Hamas seems determined to pursue and is a key Israeli target: the sophisticated network of tunnels built by Hamas and used by its supporters to transport weapons and launch attacks on Israel. Jody Radoran, Jerusalem bureau chief for our partner, The New York Times, recently got a tour of these tunnels, and she joins us now from Jerusalem. Jody, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Todd.
Good to have you. Jody, it's clear that the Israeli Defense Forces want the world to see what they're dealing with in terms of Hamas tunnels that run under their territory. You went inside, so take us inside some of these tunnels.
Well, it's interesting because we've heard about the sort of labyrinthian network under Gaza with lots of sort of offshoots and shafts, and this was not like that. I sort of expected that. This tunnel is quite a bit underground, about 46 feet down, and you have to duck to get into it, but then you can stand up, pretty much medium height person can stand. It's very, I think, professionally built, concrete walls and curved concrete top. And the one I was in was just totally straight and not much going on in it. There was an iron rod running along one wall where electricity cables were. And there was a lattice kind of metal thing on the bottom that they said was tracks for carriages to truck out the sand. And they said both of those things showed them that this tunnel wasn't finished, because the ones that have been used in to penetrate Israel for attacks, they've checked and they don't have those things anymore. So they thought the fact that especially the carriage tracks were still there meant they were still digging.
So, Jody, there's a network of these tunnels inside Gaza, of course, and some of them extend into Israeli territory. How are they used? Of course, weapons must be transported through people. That's kind of obvious. But how does Hamas really use the tunnels?
Right. As you say, there are different kinds of tunnels. There are smuggling tunnels. There are, I think, storage and rocket manufacturing tunnels within Gaza. The ones that lead into Israeli territory are something that people have known about for a little while and have become an increasing focus of this war. And those, the Israelis fear, and I think they've seen borne out over the last couple of weeks, Palestinian militants can come into Israel and attack either soldiers or civilians. The real fear is that they'll come to some kibbutz and spray the dining hall with machine gun fire. Or in one case, they were found some tranquilizers and plastic handcuffs. And so the fear is that they try to kidnap people. Last night, there was an attack actually closer to the border through a tunnel on an Israeli military post, a watchtower and a building right next to it. And they killed five Israeli soldiers and then were trying to actually take a body of one of the soldiers back through the tunnel. And soldiers from the watchtower shot at them and killed or injured one of them. And then they did all get back into the tunnel, but without an Israeli body.
So, Jody Radoran, you write in your piece about sort of the psychological fear, sort of the group psychology fear of tunnels that exists in Israel. But what about the actual strategic threat of these tunnels? Often, especially with terrorism or in a war, the psychological fear of a threat is different than the actual strategic threat itself.
Right. I mean, it's really interesting. One of the many kind of asymmetries and imbalances in this conflict and in this particular war between Gaza and Israel is in kind of what constitutes a casualty or what kinds of impacts you can have on each other's society. So for years, the primary tool from Gaza was rocket fire. And the primary impact in Israel was not really death, but it was this constant running into bomb shelters and this kind of disruption of life. And now there's a new thing going on. I think people really had learned to kind of cope with the rockets, both between the bomb shelters and with this Iron Dome system that shoots them out of the sky as they come to cities. But they don't seem to have an answer to the tunnel threat. And it's totally freaking people out. A lot of the people who live in those areas have left their homes for now weeks. The threat is really permeating the society.
So, Jody, I'd like to ask sort of about the timing of Israeli officials allowing you and other reporters into the tunnels. Of course, Benjamin Netanyahu remains very, very popular at home. But in the international community, there's a great deal of condemnation, and even in the United States, some ambivalence about the asymmetric conflict that's going on between Israel and Gaza. What do you make of the timing here? Is there a sense that the Israeli justification because of rockets has sort of faltered and they want those of us in the United States or readers of the New York Times, for instance, to see, hey, there's another threat here. It's not in the air, but it's below the ground.
Well, I want to clarify one thing, too, because I do think that the Israelis are pushing the tunnel story, but I asked to go in the tunnels. So I don't think, you know, I've been criticized for kind of just taking what the IDF hands out, what the Israeli military hands out. And I do want to be clear that I asked to go.
Indeed.
That said, you definitely have seen from the moment during this war when the first tunnel attack came, which was Thursday morning, July 17th. And then that night they went into a ground operation. And you have seen really since then, it's, you know, you almost never hear an Israeli leader talking without them mentioning the tunnels. They've published a lot of photos of them and videos of them being blown up. I think that they probably rightly feel like for all of the horrific images that people around the world are seeing of the devastation and death being wrought on Gaza, that there is a sympathy around the world for the idea that, you know, your enemy should not be able to tunnel into your territory and attack people. So, yeah, they're certainly pushing it, but I don't think they're pushing it in like some way that has nothing to do with something real. It really is what they're afraid of.
Jody Reduran is Jerusalem Bureau Chief for our partner, The New York Times. You can read her story going inside Hamas tunnels in The New York Times. Jody, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Well, the midterm elections are coming. You know, every 2 years, voters get a chance to shuffle the deck that makes up Congress. You throw back a few kings, get rid of a queen or two, discard the jokers, for sure. Thing is, voters usually don't. Incumbency runs rampant in Congress, but this year, the Senate shuffle could be different. Democrats are in control of the Senate. They have been for 8 years, but Republicans feel like they have a real shot to win the pot and take back the Senate in 2014. This week here at The Takeaway, we're taking a closer look at some of the 36 Senate races across the country, the ones that could flip the Senate. Stick with me in my card game metaphor here, because to look at how the game for the Senate might go, we're playing an old-fashioned match of Senate Hold'em. Joining me now at the felt-covered card table today and tomorrow is Ken Rudin, host of the Political Junkie podcast. Hey, Ken, sidle up to the table here and ante up.
Thank you.
All right, great. I've got my political deck of cards here that we're going to sort of use to choose which races we talk about. All right, now we've just cut the deck. I'm going to confess this deck is stacked because we're not going to go over all 36 races in the Senate, just the ones that really, really matter. And choose your first card there, Ken, if you would. Get that there.
Got it.
Got that? Okay, flip that over. All right, you've chosen Alaska. This is Senator Mark Begich, the Democrat, versus Dan Sullivan. Begich is vulnerable.
He is vulnerable because, as a matter of fact, when he was the first elected in 2008, he beat Ted Stevens, the longtime incumbent, by the barest of margins. And the only reason he beat Ted Stevens was he was just convicted of obstruction and corruption charges. So Begich, you know, you don't usually elect Democrats to the Senate in Alaska. The previous one was in 1974. But the Republicans still have a Senate primary to go through. There's an August 19th primary. And there are three Republicans, including Dan Sullivan, who have been beating each other up, saying they're not either not conservative enough, not anti-Obama enough. So Begich is a smart campaigner. His father, of course, served in Congress. It's a very Republican state, but the Republicans have this habit, this knack of eating their own, and we'll see if that happens in Alaska.
All right. cut the deck. Ken, choose your card there.
Okay, I got it.
You got it. Oh, ooh, New Hampshire. Now you've got incumbent Senator Gene Shaheen, the Democrat, against Scott Brown. You know, I seem to remember him being in the Senate, Scott Brown, from another state, from neighboring Massachusetts. What's he doing in New Hampshire?
Well, hoping to win in a better terrain. He was elected in 2010 to fill Ted Kennedy's seat. And, of course, Massachusetts never elects Republicans. And we saw that again in 2012 when he got his head clobbered by Elizabeth Warren. So he moved to New Hampshire, where he has a summer home. And, you know, he's probably the strongest Republican candidate, although not all the Republicans in the state welcome him. But at the same time, Gene Shaheen is a first-term incumbent, former governor, very powerful campaigner, very effective campaigner. And while Scott Brown got a lot of attention by trying to be the first senator in perhaps a century who could represent two different states, Gene Shaheen is a very strong campaigner. Right now, she has anywhere between an 8- and 10-point lead. It's going to be tough for Scott Brown. But again, the president is not popular in New Hampshire. The Affordable Care Act is not popular. He's hoping for an anti-Obama backlash. But again, Gene Shaheen is a very shrewd and savvy campaigner.
New Hampshire is definitely in play, but that's one of the states that the Democratic campaigners think they can hold on to in what might be a Republican wave or a Republican flip. All right, let's move on. Let me get my shuffle here. All right, cut that. Go ahead, Ken.
Okay.
Now, this is Louisiana. Now, we're down south. Senator Mary Landrieu, the incumbent, against Congressman Bill Cassidy. Now, it's really close down there, and also Louisiana has a really screwy election system. This one could drag on.
Well, it does, because all the candidates are on the same ballot, regardless of party, and they're on the same ballot on November 4th, which is Election Day. So if no candidate gets 50% of the vote, because in addition to Bill Cassidy, there's a Tea Party Republican on the ballot as well. So if nobody gets a majority, the election goes to a runoff on December 6th. So theoretically, if the balance of power for the Senate rests on Louisiana, we may not know who controls the Senate until December 6th. What's interesting about Louisiana, it's one of those red states where President Obama is very unpopular. His environmental policies are very unpopular. And you have a pretty good congressman, Bill Cassidy, who is the leading Republican candidate. But having said that, Mary Landrieu has won three times. She's a chair of the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee, and she's very strong with the oil and gas industry, the energy people. So many of the energy folks, the political action committees around the country and in Washington, who usually support Republicans, are giving heavily to Landrieu because she votes their way. So it's frustrating for the Republicans. They think that if they're going to win the Senate, they have to win Louisiana. But at the same time, there's a lot of money, a lot of PAC money, usually that goes to Republicans, is going to Mary Landrieu.
If anybody wants to know just how crazy a Louisiana election could be well into December, Google the term jungle primary. You'll learn a lot. It can get crazy down there. All right, let's...
Or is the way I would call it, how's by you?
let's get one more race in here. Ken, hang on. Let me... All right, the deck is yours.
Okay, got it.
Ooh,
oh, wow.
The ace of spades,
wow.
Kentucky, Senator Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader of the Senate, against Allison Lundergan Grimes, a credible challenger in red Kentucky.
Well, here's what's fascinating about this. I mean, we're talking about control of the Senate, and of course we know the Republicans need a net gain of 6 seats, and most of these states that the Republicans think they're going to win are in states that where Mitt Romney won in 2012. You know, the Alaskas, the North Carolinas, the West Virginias, the Arkansas of the world, but they also have to remember that there are some Republicans who are not that popular as well. Mitch McConnell has been in the Senate since 1985, as unpopular as President Obama is in Kentucky. But again, he is trying to link Allison Grimes, who is the Secretary of State. She's been elected statewide, trying to link her to President Obama, to President Obama's unpopular environmental and coal industry decisions. And so basically, if you look at the ballot in Republican eyes, it'll be Mitch McConnell versus President Obama, not Allison Grimes.
The outside money is all over this race, Ken Rudin. This could be one of the most expensive Senate races in history.
Well, it's certainly the most in Kentucky history. And again, you have to go back to 1932, the last time a Republican Senate leader was defeated in the election. So McConnell knows that. But the thing is, McConnell has always been in tough situations in previous elections. He somehow knows how to win. And right now, the odds are that he does eke out another term.
Still, can we imagine a scenario, as we're talking about the likelihood of the Senate flipping from Democratic to Republican, Ken Rudin? a scenario in which Republicans take the Senate, but Mitch McConnell, who has fought so long to get his scepter back as majority leader, has to stay home and watch it?
That would be the ultimate irony. But my guess is that if Kentucky goes Democratic, then there won't be that national Republican wave that the GOP is hoping for. And so Kentucky has to be retained by the Republicans if they're going to make Mitch McConnell the majority leader.
All right. Ken Rudin, host of the Political Junkie podcast and former political editor for NPR. Thanks for playing us Senate Hold'em with me.
Thanks a lot, Todd.
You're a lousy bluffer. I want you to know that.
Right.
No poker face. Take a band like Garbage there from the 90s, right? You've got Shirley Manson on vocals and keyboards, Steve Marker on guitar, Duke Erickson on bass, and Butch Vig on the drums. All the classic elements you need to put together a band to create music. But what if you flip the script? What if, instead of Garbage making music, you make music from Garbage?
As you spin the hard drives, it produces a sound just as if you would pluck a string. And then there's a numpad, you know, so the numbers that you'd have on the side of the keyboard, I have just a standalone numpad on the left-hand side of the device. So when you hold it around your neck, that basically rests in your hand just the same place that the fretboard would be. So just as you would play a fretboard on a guitar, you hit the numpad keys on this instrument. So it does kind of take the form of a guitar.
That's Colton Jackson. He's a musician and founder of the Electric Waste Orchestra in Urbana, Illinois. And he's playing the music you hear on what he calls a hard drive guitar. Instead of six strings, he's actually playing six old hard drives and an old keyboard number pad all strung together.
It's in the form of a guitar. I kind of resisted calling it a guitar for a while because it doesn't have any strings.
Now, technically, the Electric Waste Orchestra isn't an orchestra at all, and Jeff Lynne is not involved. But it is a group that meets up and hosts a summer camp for kids, all using instruments made exclusively out of e-waste. But how do a bunch of 4-gig hard drives actually translate into music?
So I'm kind of doing the reverse of what hard drives are meant for. So when they're in your computer sends electricity to the motor to make it spin, right? That's how it reads and writes data. So once I've cracked them open and tear all the circuitry off of it, it's just a nice silver disc attached to a motor. And when you spin the motor by hand, it generates electricity. Each hard drive is hooked up to a different pitch. So when I spin a disc, it just makes this note kind of fade in and out of the air. And the faster I spin it, the louder that note gets. So I'll just spin that one kind of at full speed. But then as soon as I stop the disc with my hand, the sound stops too. And I can do multiple discs at once. So I can start doing stuff like... where the numpad comes in is once I have the disc spinning... that turns the volume up on each of those notes that the hard drive's connected to, but I can change what notes it produces with the numpad on the end. So just like I would be playing the fretboard of a guitar. So I'm changing the pitch just by clicking the keys on the numpad. So it's a combination of what note I set it to and then what discs I'm spinning. That produce, the music that I want to play.
When you started out with just the disc spinning and it has that airy kind of wispy sound, I thought, God, computer hard drives, modern technology, it just sounds like an old Calliope. I've heard that before.
It's the sound that you're hearing, it's as simple as can be. It's a sine wave. And so I'm using just a digital oscillator in the software. And it's a very basic sound, a sound that a lot of people can... A calliope, there's probably a lot of things people think of when they hear that, because it's a sound they've heard before. It's as simple as can be. It's a sine wave.
Now, of course, we both know you're not going to solve the worldwide problem of e-waste, electronic hardware waste, by building new things or interesting instruments out of them. But for you, this is really about sort of the art of computer programming and innovation more than it is about recycling, right?
Mm-hmm. I wanted to find a way to just make it interesting. So this pile of materials. Really, I picked e-waste because it's something that I had for free. And it's something that I imagine a lot of people have for free. You know, there's stockpiles of these computer parts in, you know, anywhere with an IT department or a community help desk, or even people that have went through a lot of computers themselves might have a stack of hard drives somewhere. And yeah, it's the computer programming, the music making, and repurposing together into a project that people could hang out and try out.
Now, kids have been doing this just this very summer at summer camp with you in charge. Is that right?
Yeah, so we got to run it as a small summer camp at the Champaign-Urbana Community Fab Lab. And so we got some kids tearing into computer parts, which I really love seeing because it's like it gives people an opportunity to tear into these pieces that are usually black boxes. You know, people are often afraid to open their computer. And, you know, it's usually a bad idea if you don't know what you're doing. But when you're using old computer parts, it doesn't matter if you break it. I mean, that's the point of doing this is you're breaking it first so you can make something new out of it. So I like giving kids and adults alike the opportunity to, you know, take a screwdriver and a hammer to these computer parts and get to see what's inside.
Any kids tempted to just get six different size monitors and say, hey, smart guy, drum set, I'm just going to hit them?
Well, hey, if they're not being used, I wouldn't tell them no.
So, all right, well, you've already built the sort of non-guitar Colton that you played for us. I know that your bench must be full of prototypes and other weird stuff. So what's next?
All right, so I have an instrument over here that I can pull out, and it's an analog circuit. So what we've heard so far is all software-based, right? And I'm, like, reading signals and interpreting them and making something musical out of them. But I wanted to come up with something a lot cheaper. You know, so this is – the other instrument needs a laptop to run, whereas this next instrument is a really cheap circuit that you can make out of about $3 or $4 of parts you can get at Radio Shack or – wherever you prefer to get electronic components. But it's just an analog amplifier plugged directly into the motor drive of a hard disk drive. So this is just taking advantage of the fact that when you spin a motor, the signal that comes off of it is a sine wave, which if you put into a speaker, you can hear. And it just so happens that it's a very low frequency sine wave. So I'll give it a spin and you can hear that this is just the sound of a hard drive motor amplified. Yeah, the faster you spin it, the higher the pitch is. So you can actually, with a little bit of practice, start hitting different notes with it.
Well, Colton Jackson, you're not the first founder of a junkyard band, but you are the founder of the Electronic Waste Orchestra. That's Colton Jackson, musician and founder of that very Electronic Waste Orchestra. Colton, thanks.
Thank you.
Yes. DC's own Junkyard Band. Man, I love it when they let me play DJ on this show. Well, if you want to see what the Electric Waste Orchestra hard drive guitar looks like, we have pictures of Colton and his instruments on our website at thetakeaway.org. Maybe you've made a waste instrument of your own. Share it with us on the website. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TiVo. No need to switch TV inputs, remotes, or interfaces to access cable TV and streaming from Netflix and Hulu Plus. Learn more at TiVo.com.
The deadliest Ebola outbreak on record continues to spread in West Africa, crossing national borders and human bodies to claim the lives of nearly 700 people. Liberia has closed most of its borders to prevent the spread of the Ebola virus. As local and international doctors work overtime, reports have emerged of other dangers facing health workers in the region. Speaking on this program yesterday, Ken Isaac, who is vice president of programs and government relations at Samaritan's Purse, told us about the violence his staff encountered in northern Liberia trying to bury someone who had died from Ebola.
We were met with a roadblock. The men in the ambulance were attacked. They were beaten. They were cut with machetes. Their car was burned. Our staff were not hurt. They were able to get away. We were not able to retrieve the body. What these reflect is that the population doesn't understand the disease. They don't have the basic knowledge to allow health care to come in. And again, this feeds into what is a growing catastrophe in West Africa.
Adia Benton has worked in Sierra Leone with the Ministry of Health, working on issues of infectious diseases. She's an assistant professor of anthropology at Brown University. Professor Benton, welcome.
Hi.
You heard that difficult-to-listen-to statement there from Ken Isaac from Samaritan's Purse, who we talked to just yesterday. How common is his experience among aid workers working in the region?
I think it's actually not very common, at least recently. But what I think they're confronted with is a disease that people are not familiar with. And a lot of, I think, ill will towards foreign intervention and also government intervention that has proven so far to be fairly inadequate.
So is it the case that an infectious disease, which might be mysterious to people, is definitely terrifying to them, is sort of a proxy for other forms of mistrust they might have for foreign aid workers, foreign governments, things like that?
Absolutely. I think that what people perceive is a inadequacy of response from the beginning. And you can see this in political cartoons. You can see this in blog posts and newspaper articles, editorials. And I think these rumors, but also this aggression towards outsiders, towards these foreign workers from Samaritan's Purse, amplifies and reflects existing mistrust and suspicion about the motivations of these different people, right? People are going into hospitals and not coming out. People are sending their loved ones into hospitals and they're not coming out. Certainly the case fatality rate is much lower than in previous cases, like Ebola in their mid-90s in Zaire. But people are still dying because they're experiencing symptoms that look like other things. And by the time they get to the hospital, people are dying. So it's reflecting mistrust, but I think there's also something about the disease that also fuels that suspicion.
Adia Benton, this is really nothing new. And in other places around the world, I can think of examples where politicians can't help but capitalize on this type of mistrust. I'm thinking Thabo Mbeki, the former president of South Africa, who fueled mistrust by claiming that HIV didn't cause AIDS. Taliban and other authorities in Pakistan accusing foreign aid workers who were vaccinating against polio of spreading U.S. propaganda and U.S. influence. This is nothing new. Is that type of political manipulation rampant in Sierra Leone and Liberia, or is it a different kind of dynamic?
Well, I don't see anyone taking advantage of it right now, right? I think what they're actually experiencing is aggression, like this representative from Samaritan's Purse described. So I don't think anyone's actually capitalizing on it quite yet. I think what's actually happening is people are worried about it because they are trying to curb the disease, but they're still not able to protect health workers from the disease itself or from people who fear them.
So what goes into the calculus then for an aid organization that wants to go into a place like Sierra Leone, Liberia, Guinea, what have you, to help? Obviously, they always think about their security. But when they want to go in to try to combat a dangerous infectious disease and they're confronting what may be real risks to the aid workers themselves, the calculus about how to handle the mission or go on the mission at all really has to change.
So aid worker security has always been the primary, and it sounds crazy to say this, but one of the things that I often critique in humanitarian aid is often there's a calculus where humanitarian aid worker security, especially international, i.e. foreign aid worker security, is actually prioritized over that of the local population. That said, it has to be more than education. It has to be more than outreach. Any kind of intervention has to be sensitive to existing political and local conflicts. I think MSF has made the point that in some communities, they've worked closely with communities to get early detection. It meant being very humble in their approach to how they're actually trying to educate people about the disease, but being very honest that this is something that very much affects the people who serve to combat it, that it is something that they can help with if identified early, but that there are going to be many losses. So this is, I think, one of the fundamental challenges when people are suspicious of the motivations of governments who take international money and haven't produced a response. They're suspicious because this is a disease that they haven't seen before and don't know the outcomes of, right? So what's fueling this right now is rumors. And rumors are, I think, as many anthropologists would argue, it's a reflection of existing tensions. And so if the rumor is that, oh, this person went to this place and survived, perhaps it would create a different kind of mood or it may relieve some of the tensions that we're currently facing right now.
It's interesting, Adia Benton, that in some cases, rumor itself is an infectious disease that can be insidious, just like viruses.
It's so true. It is very interesting.
Adia Benton is assistant professor of anthropology at Brown University. She's worked in Sierra Leone with the Ministry of Health there. Professor, thank you.
Thank you.
Before we leave you this hour, as Muslims around the world are celebrating the end of Ramadan and the Eid holiday this week, we bring you these voices from around the country.
My name is Fatima.
My name is Ibrahim.
My name is Hussein Rashid.
Hi, this is Hani Atiya. I am calling from San Leandro, California.
My name is Zara Norbakhsh. I'm a Muslim, feminist, Iranian-American comedian.
I'm Nasser. I'm calling from Charlotte, North Carolina.
And this is our Ramadan reflection.
And this is my Ramadan reflection.
And this is my Ramadan reflection.
So for me, Ramadan has been a lot of clarity, a lot of deep thinking, a lot of idea generation.
I think of perseverance. I think of incredible stamina, seeing my mom fasting, coming home for iftar, working three jobs.
It is a month of appreciation for all the bounties that God has given us. And I think that the month of Ramadan really helps to bring a spiritual equilibrium for nearly one-fifth of the world's population.
And it was much more of a reminder about how people around the world are not voluntarily fasting.
This month has been extremely difficult with all the war and horror that we see in the world.
We are supposed to feel for others. This is just a time when it's reserved for us to appreciate all the blessings that we have.
For me, Ramadan has been a time to refresh and reboot my spiritual side.
Spirituality is not withdrawing from the world or ignoring the world. It is about reinvigorating myself to do good in the world, to not just pray for peace, but to work for peace and justice.
It's been a really beautiful, wonderful, awesome Ramadan.
Thanks to all of you who shared your Ramadan reflections, and Eid Mubarak to every one of you. And thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry this week. This is The Takeaway.
Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, personalized brain training programs developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving through games. Learn more at Lumosity.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.